In rock and roll lore, the outdoor music festival at Northern California's Altamont Speedway on December 6, 1969, has become the evil twin of Woodstock and the day when the 60s promise of peace and love was shattered by the murder of concertgoer Meredith Hunter by members of the Hells Angels who'd been enlisted to act as security. In his new book, Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day, Joel Selvin probes every aspect of the show, from the initial idea of a free concert featuring the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, and the Rolling Stones, through the last-minute change of venues, bad LSD, and ultimately murder, literally at the feet of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Very pleased to welcome rock historian Joel Selvin to our show today. Hello.
Great to be here, Leonard.
What was the impetus to write a book about Altamont now, 48 years after the concert took place?
You know,
just because the Rolling Stones are still performing?
I spent so much time around that. I worked at the San Francisco Chronicle as the pop music critic starting in 1970, and the stench was still in the air. It was a year after that. So I came to know all the people that played on the show, a lot of people that worked on it as stagehands, and a lot of people that attended.
Who came up with the idea for the concert? What was the original concept?
So Rock Scully, the manager of the Grateful Dead, was arrested at Heathrow Airport. He was going to London to advise on how to do free concerts in the park. And the Keith Richards discovered that Rock had left a suitcase full of exotic high-grade marijuana at Heathrow, and he made Rock go get it, and they spent the night sampling this stuff. During the course of the evening, Rock told Keith that he could fix it for the Stones to play a free concert in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park.
Was it important for it to be free?
Well, that was the kind of thinking of the day. The Woodstock had just taken place. San Francisco was noted for free concerts in the park. And in fact, the Stones themselves had just played their biggest audience ever in London's Hyde Park at a free concert that July.
Now, what were a bunch of bands immediately willing to join in?
Well, immediately there were no real plans. It was something that the Stones sort of talked about and thought about, and then when they got to America, they met with Rock and got him working on it. Finding the place for it was the real difficult thing.
Now, why were the organizers denied the proper permits to hold a concert in Golden Gate State Park?
Well, the Grateful Dead had that pretty much wired, but the Rolling Stones front office took over the permit process at some point. Oh, we can handle this. I'll call the mayor directly. And they didn't understand the subtleties of San Francisco park permits, and that was just over as soon as they picked up the phone to the mayor's office.
So venues kept on changing.
They found a place on Tuesday before the Saturday of the concert and started to build a stage and erect a sound system. The owners of that particular racetrack found out about it on Wednesday, and they demanded a fee for rental, and they were in the film business, so they wanted a piece of the movie. They wanted to distribute the movie, and the Stones refused to negotiate. So there was a stalemate that was just going on until late Thursday afternoon when they found this other speedway way outside San Francisco, way past the suburbs, way past Exurbia, past cow pastures. It was a almost out-of-business place called Altamont. The guy's biggest audience before had been 6,000 people for a demolition derby.
And how many people showed up for this concert?
They figured about 300,000. There was no food, there was no water, there was 100 toilets. It wasn't really well prepared.
Well, it's the whole thing sounds so makeshift. They don't know where they're going to be performing just days before they perform. And wasn't it the Rolling Stones' idea to involve Hell's Angels in the concert?
So Rock Scully told the Stones tour director, Sam Cutler, that they needed to invite the Angels because they were coming anyway. So they met with the Hell's Angels in San Francisco. And at that time, the concert was planned for Golden Gate Park, which meant that the San Francisco chapter of the Hells Angels would have jurisdiction. And those guys were well known to the bands. They hung out backstage. They rode their bikes together. They were altogether more civilized brand of Hells Angels than, say, the San Jose chapter. And those were the guys, the San Jose guys, that were in the front of the stage causing all the problems.
And the Stones had actually used the London Hells Angels in a concert. But those guys...
Yeah, they drew their colors on with chalk. They rode mopeds. They drank tea. I don't think they really knew what the California Hells Angels were about.
So they just assumed that they would be the same as the ones in London.
Yeah, I think they thought they were going to be, you know, exotic animals tame enough to pet.
You mentioned the movies. At what point did Albert and David Maisels enter the picture?
Right, in the last stages of the tour, just a couple of days before the final shows in New York, and they were able to shoot a couple of the Madison Square Garden shows, but they certainly didn't have a whole movie by that time.
But to some degree, they were lucky. The Maisels were great filmmakers.
The Maisels were the guys. They were the documentary filmmakers of record at that point.
And how were the Rolling Stones shows on the tour being received by the critics and the fans?
Oh, the Rolling Stones arrived in this country hailed as conquering heroes. I mean, 1969, rock music was a huge cultural fascination, and Woodstock had taken place in August, and when the Rolling Stones showed up, they were greeted like avatars.
But the Beatles had already broken up, so the Stones were the dominant group at this point.
Beatles were about to break up, but they certainly weren't touring.
Why? You mentioned that previous one was the Sears Point Raceway.
That's right.
That ended, and then Altamont finally. But was it hard for people to get to Altamont? Because Woodstock, one of the part of the lore of Woodstock is that it was almost impossible to get there, and cars were backed up on the thruway, and people were walking miles just to make the site.
Yeah, the Highway Patrol reported a 10-mile backup both directions at Altamont. Some people say it was worse than that. Some people say you could get through it. But they were just abandoning cars on hillsides and by the sides of roads and just flooding over these vacant lots.
Was an agreement actually, an signed agreement made with the Hells Angels?
No, you don't sign agreements with the Hells Angels. The Angels just showed up, and not all of them, by the way, misbehaved. Some of them were very, very helpful. Some of them were as appalled and aghast at what went on as anybody. There was a whole variety of Hells Angels there that day, and they behaved all kinds of different ways.
How were they to be paid?
Oh, they were just invited. Everybody was just invited. Nobody was paid.
Did anybody have any idea of how many people were going to show up for this concert?
I think that they assumed that there was going to be a massive crowd. The polo fields in Golden Gate Park, where the original concert site was, easily contained 100,000 people. So that's what they were looking at to begin with.
There was a lot of supposedly bad LSD going around that day, and a number of performers and attendees described a bad vibe that surrounded the venue. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that?
Well, in 1967, the Summer of Love, the people who made LSD, they were missionaries, and the chemists went to great lengths to make sure those compounds were stable. 2 years later, it had devolved into a criminal enterprise, and people making that stuff, well, they were putting strychnine in it, they were lacing it with methamphetamine. And the psychiatrists that worked the backstage, I spoke to those guys, and they were appalled at what they were seeing. And these were not babies. They'd been around San Francisco. They'd seen drug use. But they were inundated from the minute they opened their tent in the morning. And given the lack of signage or announcements from the stage, they were assuming that they were seeing just the tiniest tip of the iceberg, that there were literally tens of thousands of LSD overdoses out there.
People having bad trips.
Bad trips.
Was there also violence other than the killing?
Oh, yes. The violence started from the very beginning. The astrologists weren't consulted, but the moon was in Scorpio, and that's a bad sign. During the first set by Santana, a concertgoer jumped up on stage, and three Hells Angels chased him down and caught him and beat him to a pulp right in front of the keyboard player. The guys in Santana were astonished and shocked and terrified. They were on this tiny stage. There were 200 people surrounding them. And the Hells Angels, who were all over the place, were taking full liberties with just anybody who tried to get up on that stage.
My guest is Joel Selvin, whose latest book is Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and the Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day, a follow-up to a book with a very different kind of message, Summer of Love?
Well, my book, Summer of Love,
It was meant to be a little ironic.
Yeah, but it's got its share of gunplay and fistfights in it, too, oddly enough. I think the Summer of Love book title was a little ironic.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Grateful Dead decided not to perform at the concert. What led them to make that decision?
In the movie, you see Jerry Garcia and Phil Lesh from the Dead walking off the helicopter, and Michael Shreve from Santana walks up and tells him that Marty Balin of the Jefferson Airplane had been beaten up by Hell's Angels, and Jerry says, "Oh, wow, bummer." He was flying on a heroic dose of a designer psychedelic called STP that Owsley developed. They get further backstage, and they find Bert Kanigsen, and Bert's a nonviolent peace activist who worked as their permit specialist and organized a lot of their stuff for them. And he'd been beaten savagely around the head by pool cues. He had 60 stitches in his head, and they wrapped a bandage around him like a turban and clocked a cowboy hat on top of him. So they saw Bert. Then they saw Rex Jackson. Rex was their one of their roadies, but Rex was the big badass. He was the guy that was their enforcer. And when he saw Animal, the Hell's Angel who beat up Marty Balin, he went after him, and Rabbit laid him out. They carried Rex off stage, so they saw Rex with two black eyes. They saw Bert with this thing on his head. They heard Marty had been beaten up, and they decided, this doesn't look like a good thing.
It's amazing anybody wanted to go on after that. It was dark by the time the Rolling Stones went on stage. Did that contribute to a sense of danger in the crowd?
Oh, it's not just dark. The temperature dropped 20 degrees. The crowd had been enduring terrible conditions without bathrooms, without water, without food. There were 40-mile-an-hour winds whipping through there, and a 2.5-hour wait for the Rolling Stones. No, it was a terrible situation.
And considering what had happened to Marty Balin, who was a rather famous musician at the time, were the Stones all worried about their own safety?
I'm not sure how much the Stones were aware of the degree of the violence. They went straight to a dressing room from a helicopter. They heard about it. I don't know how much they saw of it. But as soon as they got out on stage and experienced the crowded stage and the menacing figures of these Hell's Angels, they were definitely terrified.
And you get that feeling when you see the Maisels film, Give Me Shelter.
Well, one of the things that was really interesting was that the spotlights failed to come in the chaos of the day. So the only stage lighting was 50,000 watts of backlight. And that meant that instead of being blinded by spotlights, the band, for once, could see everything that was happening in front of them. So all through their set, they were watching people getting beaten savagely, and they couldn't do anything about it.
What led to the stabbing death of this 18-year-old girl, Meredith Hunter?
He was a guy.
A guy.
But so the third song of the set was Sympathy for the Devil, and Sonny Barger of the Oakland Hells Angels saw a concert goer jumping on a bike, shorting out a battery and causing a fire. He charged out there, knocked the kid off the bike, and put out the fire. All the other angels saw Sonny charge into the crowd. They didn't know what he was doing. They just followed him and started laying waste to people. They calmed down the audience. That's when Jagger goes, brothers and sisters. They stop playing, you know. The next song, Under My Thumb, also they have problems with this, and that's when Hunter tried to climb up on the stage. He was pushed back down, and they started, a number of Hell's Angels jumped on him, four or five of them kicking him, beating him, and he pulled out a gun. At which point, Alan Pissarro, a San Jose Hell's Angel, pulled a knife out of an ankle holster and jumped on Meredith's back, stabbed him in the neck and the back four times.
And he was acquitted of the murder because they said it was self-defense.
Well, the Maisels filmmaker, cinematographer Baird Bryant, caught the whole altercation. And it's very clear. You see Hunter pull the gun out as he gets loose of the angels who are beating him. And then, just as he does, Pissarro jumps on him.
How responsible did the Stones feel at the time about their part in this matter?
They didn't pay any of their bills on the entire tour. They never contacted Hunter's family. They blew out of town the next day with the cash from the tour and never looked back. They stranded their tour director, Sam Cutler, and never paid him or called him again.
Have they ever spoken about Altamont in the years that followed?
Very little.
In the afterword to the book, you say that you declined an invitation to go to the actual concert. You write, I knew better than to go to Altamont.
Yeah, well, it was obvious to me that this wasn't going to be a frolic in the park like the old Jefferson Airplane Grateful Dead concerts. It was on a hill outside Tracy, California. It just smelled of disaster to me from that, all that far away.
Well, there were other incidents around this time, and even Woodstock wasn't incident-free. But do you think Altamont really has a legacy that is unique to that event?
Oh, absolutely. People think about that word Altamont like Titanic to ocean travel. It just rings up this whole dark image of the Rolling Stones on stage and all the evil that they've sort of assimilated over the years, the Hell's Angels who are authentically evil, and killing a young black guy who brought his white girlfriend. I mean, that's pretty resonant stuff.
And were there any concerts, free concerts after that? Or did this kind of put an end to that kind of thinking?
There's plenty of free concerts there always. So it didn't end anything. It didn't end the movement. It didn't end the counterculture. You know, it really didn't end anything.
Joel Selvin will be signing copies of his book tonight at 7 o'clock at the Nighthawk Cinema in Brooklyn before a 7:30 screening of Gimme Shelter. Afterward, he'll be doing a Q&A as well with Danny Goldberg, who's the president of Gold VE Entertainment.
Yeah, Gold Mountain. He's a rock band manager, former Warner Brothers records president.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the book is called Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and The Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day. It is published by Day Street, which is an imprint of William Morrow.
HarperCollins.
Which is all, they're all part of the same big conglomerate.
There's only one company, I guess.
Yes. Soon there's going to be one publisher, and that's it. But it's lucky you have friends there. Joel, thank you so much for being
here. Thank you, Leonard. It's great to be here with you.